You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, meet two war correspondents who give us a behind-the-scenes look at the dangerous job of reporting from a war zone. And they'll tell us why they do it. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, the World Health Organization recently released two health advisories related to artificial sweeteners. In May, the WHO recommended against the use of non-sugar sweeteners for the goal of reducing body weight. And earlier this month, the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified the artificial sweetener aspartame as possibly carcinogenic to humans. Dr. Francesco Branca, who directs the Department of Nutrition and Food Safety at the World Health Organization, said most people do not consume enough aspartame to be at risk, but the finding shows a need for further research.
We are comfortable that the occasional level of exposure, which is far from the acceptable daily intake, is safe or is not producing appreciable health risk. The problem is for high consumers, and the problem is for situations where and consumption are shifting towards high consumer. But I think our results do not indicate that occasional consumption should pose a risk to most consumers.
The FDA says it still considers aspartame safe for human consumption under current regulations. So what's a consumer to do with this information? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions or concerns do you have about natural or artificial sweeteners? Do you avoid some or all of them? Do you feel like some affect you differently than others? Do you like artificial sweeteners maybe better than regular sugar? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen, is an assistant professor of biochemistry at Medical College of Wisconsin. Her lab researches natural and artificial sweeteners and how they influence pregnancy, development, and metabolism. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, with this news from the World Health Organization, it seems like, okay, a little concern, need for no research. It doesn't seem like anybody's saying we should be panicking about our artificial sweeteners right now. Does that feel about right to you?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly the take-home message of this. The World Health Organization is calling for more basic research on aspartame. There was some alarming study, and I think that's what this report was filled in the first place. But it's really, for now, at least, we really do not have enough evidence based on the amount of person that were assessing those study. We do not have statistical power to say that there is for sure a risk. And so we just need to do a lot more to be able to assess that.
You do a lot of research related to artificial sweeteners, and we'll get into that. But first of all, can you tell us, what are they? What goes into making aspartame that makes it a sweetener that we can use?
Yeah, so there's as you mentioned, there's different category of artificial sweeteners and natural sweeteners. So we differentiate them by the fact that either they're man-made, so they were created by us. They do not exist in natural form in nature, versus natural sweeteners such as stevia, monk fruit, who are actually found in plants, naturally found in plants and extracted from it. Artificial sweeteners are made and just have been found to taste sweet, and compared to natural sugar, which is our common table sugar, for example, we do not get any calories from it. So they've been advertised for not having any effect on our blood sugar, for example. They just are good to taste sweet for us, but that's it. They do not trigger any metabolic response from it.
Which seems a little weird. What do we know about what our body is doing with, say, aspartame?
Yeah, so there's also subcategories in those artificial sweeteners. So aspartame is a separate case almost from all of the other artificial sweeteners. Aspartame is actually break down by our body and makes other molecules, including phenylalanine, methanol, and so aspartame, this is what it does, but neither of those molecules makes a caloric input. So it doesn't transform artificial sweeteners into a sugar that we can actually make energy from or store as fat, for example, or do anything else. And all of the other sweeteners, so we know saccharin, for example, like Sweet and Low brand, sucralose, like Splenda, All of those are actually intact molecules. They're called inert. And so they do travel our body, but they don't. We don't break them down into anything else. So they are excreted the same way we ingest them.
Now, you mentioned aspartame breaks down into phenylalanine. Now, there's the condition of, what is it, phenylketonuria, that people are supposed to avoid that. Are people with PKU, phenylketonuria, they should avoid aspartame. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's been recommended by the FDA a while ago, as soon as it was put into food. This condition is a rare genetic disease where people cannot break down phenylalanine, and they build up phenylalanine in their body and it becomes toxic. And so usually what we recommend for those people is to get on a low phenylalanine diet. So they should monitor really their phenylalanine input. And so they are one of the category where they should not have aspartame at all in their diet.
Talking to Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen, assistant professor of biochemistry at Medical College of Wisconsin, looking at aspartame, other artificial sweeteners. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on artificial sweeteners. Do you use them instead of sugary stuff? Do you avoid them? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephanie, this is a big subject of your research, including with during pregnancy. What kind of things are you looking at when it comes to artificial sweeteners?
Yeah, so my laboratory, we're interested in we're not really looking into aspartame. We're actually looking at two other sweeteners called sucralose and acesulfam potassium. And so those two sweeteners are the most commonly combination in diet sodas, for example. So every single diet soda you find out there usually have both sweeteners in there. And so what we are looking at is actually potentially what the effect could be during pregnancy. So if a mother would drink artificial sweeteners during pregnancy and the effect on the offspring. So I'm a basic scientist. I'm a biochemist. So we look mostly, we mimic human model in more simple models. So animal models, usually rodent. And so we feed pregnant them artificial sweeteners, and we're looking at what the offspring have or have not, or if it's safe for pregnant women to consume.
And one big point I've seen you make elsewhere in other interviews is you'd like to see a lot more research into artificial sweeteners and what they do in our bodies and whether we pass them along. What other kind of research are you hoping to see, whether you're doing it or others around the country?
Yeah, so one other thing we've come to appreciate in our research is that we know that artificial sweeteners are safe for general population. One of the things we are starting to understand, the same way as you mentioned for the PKU patient, is that there may be some specific condition in which artificial sweetener might not be as recommended. One of the things that we are also looking at, for example, is it's a combination of artificial sweeteners consumption and something else. So let's say you would be on a heavy drug treatment, on chemotherapy, those kind of things. So do we have interaction between sweeteners and other drug, and our body cannot handle as much because of artificial sweeteners? And the same way as pregnancy, as I was saying, there's a lot to do with the offspring. The babies are a developing metabolism, and so they are trying to build up all their mechanism to store glucose properly to create energy from nutrient. And having sweeteners at that time, it's kind of a hard take, because now we're training a body to say, well, this is a sweet, but it doesn't have any caloric input, which is not a normal response. And so that's kind of like where the realm where we're trying, we definitely need a lot more research to understand if it's really a good thing or not to consume during early life or pregnancy.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Cyril is with us in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi there. I'm enjoying your conversation. I'm a nutritionist by trade, although I'm not practicing anymore. But the PKU, phenylketonuria, is a really serious issue. And I know aspartame has been a big part of that for years and years. And actually, I'm holding a bottle of Diet Coke in my hand right now. And it does have a warning, which is not very prominent on the label, saying phenylketonuric contains phenylalanine, which is, like I say, it's there, but it's not very prominent along, and it has other sweeteners in it, which sort of dilutes the importance of the other one actually being there.
Gotcha. Thanks. Cyril, thanks a lot for the call. Stephanie, a couple big labeling questions there. First of all, given the risk to a part of the population, should that warning be, as Cyril seems to be suggesting, more prominent?
Yeah, so it is. For people with PKU, they've been diagnosed really early on. This is something that showed up really quickly at birth, and it's part of the screening also, early birth screening in Wisconsin particularly. They should know they would not consume. So I'm expecting those that are really have PKU diagnosed, they would know not to consume those. So that's, I think that's fine. The labeling of artificial sweeteners is tricky in a sense that people sometimes do not recognize what a sweetener is or not. So sucralose, for example, sounds a lot like sucrose, which is our natural sugar. So 3 in 4 people cannot actually identify properly sweeteners on label. The other trick that that is on those labels is that we don't really know how much we have. So if you look at a food label or a drink label, you have a list of additives that were put on there, or like glucose. Sometimes you have vitamins, minerals, something like this. And then it starts with the higher amount and then it finished by the lower amount. But we don't really know what that amount is. And it's not required to put any amount of artificial sweeteners. So that's kind of a problem, both in research for us, because how do you assess how much a person actually consume a day? The only thing we can say is pretty much they're a frequent user, so they would do every day or not, and kind of how much diet soda they drink, something like this, but that's pretty much it. So it's hard also for consumer to assess how much they are drinking or if they are within the guideline of the FDA, for example.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen, Medical College of Wisconsin biochemistry professor, looking at natural and artificial sweeteners and how they affect our health after the World Health Organization issued not a panic type warning, but saying, hey, they're possibly carcinogenic for humans. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen, biochemistry professor at Medical College of Wisconsin, with us today for a look at recent news about artificial sweeteners. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Stephanie, before we go back to our callers, I want to talk about this World Health Organization statement. You know, aspartame possibly carcinogenic for humans. That sounds bad, but there's other categories: carcinogenic, probably carcinogenic, possibly, and non. A lot of the things we encounter in our lives might fit into possibly or more carcinogenic.
Yeah, exactly. So they did classify. So we're just one category into kind of the carcinogenic. So it is. It is everything in that category, usually stuff that have been submitted somehow to the WHO as a report with some studies, some basic research that have been done, and that would go into that category. So there's a lot of stuff potentially that could end up in this. And again, it is clear that the statement is that we need more research to be able to conclude this. So it is kind of a to-watch category.
Go back to our callers now. Ethan is with us in Madison. Ethan, hi.
Hi. I'm curious if consuming artificial...
I think we lost our connection with Ethan. Ethan, our producer says, was interested in whether these artificial sweeteners affect insulin response. Stephanie, is there an impact on insulin response from consuming artificial sweeteners?
So the original idea was that sweeteners do not impact insulin response. Now, after a couple years of research now, like decades, I would say, of research now, we know that they do bind the sweet receptor, and you have sweet receptor all over your body. That's something that usually people don't think about, but we do have sweet taste receptor in our gut, for example. This is one of the places where sweetener will bind and signal to our intestine and then and our body that there is nutrient coming, there's sugar coming. And a sweet receptor cannot make the difference between a sugar and a non-nutritive sweeteners or aspartame or anything. So the response to this is to secrete hormone in the gut that will signal to ingest sugar and then metabolize it and then go with the normal sugar response. One of this normal sugar response is secretion of insulin, so we can ingest properly our glucose and then store it. So we know sweeteners impact the gut response for sure. The insulin, we're still a little bit in between. I think we still need more study for this, but it definitely does signal in the gut pretty well. As far as the downstream of insulin, so increase in glucose concentration that is linked to insulin resistance, for example, this has been shown with sweeteners. So we know that long-term sweeteners exposure lead to increased basal glucose level, which is your blood sugar that would signal you for pre-diabetic.
Thanks a lot for that call. Sorry we lost the connection. William joins us now in Marshall. William, hello.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, William?
I would like to ask about the value of alcohol sugars or sugar alcohols in terms of, you know, whether they have that same response with the effect of the insulin. And also, do you have a website where we can go and read up on the man's work?
You mean on our guest research, William?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, William, thanks. First of all, alcohol sugars.
Yeah, so alcohol sugar are regulated as well by the FDA, but they're not as sweet as our nutritive sweeteners, and that's part of why they're not used as much. They're also not as cheap as produced, so we don't have as much. But like as far as what we know, they bind this receptor, but not as good as, let's say, sucralose or aspartame, and that's make them less sweet for us. So there is not a ton of sugar on research story on sugar alcohol like sorbitol and all of this and their effects. The fact that they're found mainly in really small quantity and really particular product like gum, for example, we're not expecting to ingest as much as, you know, drinking diet sodas. So I think that's part of why we don't have as much research on it. But yeah, so far so good. Let's put it this way.
And William was wondering if there's a good place to follow your research, Stephanie.
yeah, I do. I have a website. You can find me on Medical College of Wisconsin website, and there's a lot of links on my research.
Thanks for the call. And I know we've had some people wonder also about non-artificial sweetener alternatives, things like stevia. Where do they fit into all of this? Is this part of what you research?
Yeah, so my own research, we haven't looked at stevia, but others have done it. One of the things that came out semi-recently was that they have fed patients with various quantity of stevia, and they haven't found any effect on glucose level, for example, while they did find some effect on basal, on blood sugar with saccharine and sucralose. So there is some research, but stevia is also a lot newer, like as a you know, really good substitute for artificial sweeteners. They have been used for a lot longer by some, for example, stevia was used a lot longer by Chinese, and we haven't seen anything. They do have the same concept as far as their binding, and they bind this food receptor. One of the major differences is that our gut microbiome actually participate in metabolizing the stevia a little bit. And so that makes our gut microbiome work. In which way, I don't think we're sure yet. But so far, we don't have a ton of research on stevia. We have a lot more on aspartame and sucralose, for example.
Time for one more caller. Ken is with us in Black River Falls. Ken, hi.
Yeah, hello. You know, something that I was wondering about is artificial flavors. For years, I've wondered what chemists sat around figuring out, let's take these things and we'll come up with artificial vanilla. That seems impossible to even imagine doing. The other thing is, we don't really have any basic information or education when it comes to what we should be eating. I mean, I cannot imagine why I would want an artificial sweetener. If I want sugar, I'll have sugar, but I usually don't want sugar. And we have very little education on this, just none.
Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Stephanie, if he wants sugar, he'll have sugar. Of course, we know there's downsides to having too much sugar in our lives, too. What do you end up doing in your own life, Stephanie, when it comes to how much and what sweeteners to actually use?
Yeah, so I'm definitely not going with too much sugar. That's another part of my lab research is the effect of regular sugar. So I definitely do not, and there's like really strong evidence that too much sugar doesn't help with, again, a lot of the metabolic disease, including obesity and diabetes. So definitely not in my own life. I'm not going full on regular sugar. I do use artificial sweeteners in really moderate concentration, the same way as the FDA advice. And I'm actually happy there's other alternative now in the market, including seltzers that are naturally flavored and with really minimal sugar. And I think the same way as we train for salts, in a sense, we are good at training for sweets. The less sweet we eat, usually the better we get with not craving for sweet. So I think we can train our body to do that.
Ken, thanks for the call. And Stephanie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Stephanie Olivier Van Stichelen is an assistant professor of biochemistry at Medical College of Wisconsin. She's with us today to explain what we know and don't know about the ways natural and artificial sweeteners influence our health. She had an interesting point there. We can train ourselves to not like sweets as much or not to crave them as much. The less we eat, the less sweet stuff we want. Well, in theory, I haven't been able to do that in my life. How about you? Have you made a decision in your life to cut back on sweets and sweeteners, whether sugar or stevia or sucralose or you name it? Let us know about it. Let me know about it. Maybe I can learn from it. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. In the last month, two 16-year-olds have died doing factory work, including one here in Wisconsin. We'll check out the state of child labor laws and child labor protections around the country, plus efforts to loosen up some of those regulations in many states that are going on right now. Plus, the big EAA air show is going on this week in Oshkosh. We'll meet two women who have broken new ground in the sky as pilots, including a Wisconsinite who ended up on the Thunderbirds in the Air Force. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, have we finally reached the end of inflation? An economics reporter gives us a snapshot of the latest trends in consumer prices and where the U.S. economy may be headed. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get the latest on criminal investigations into former President Trump related to efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. First, inflation is cooling down significantly. Last month, it hit a two-year low with a 3% increase. That's getting closer to the Federal Reserve's target of 2%. It could be a turning point for the U.S. economy, but the Fed isn't declaring victory quite yet. Our next guest is with us for a look at some of the causes of longer-term inflation, including accusations of greedflation, where companies keep charging more because they can. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed price changes lately at the grocery store, the gas pump? Are you able to afford rent or a house in the community you want to live in? What questions do you have about the long-term progress, the saga of inflation? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lydia DePillis is a reporter on the business desk at the New York Times. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
This 3% number sounds pretty good compared to where we were, say, a year ago in particular, a big drop from then. How big a deal is this one data point from last week?
Well, it's certainly really good to see. It's down from 9% back in June 2022, but it's not a done deal at the moment. And that's what you'll see the Fed be concerned about going forward. This is a well-timed conversation coming right before the July Fed meeting tomorrow, where they will decide how much to raise interest rates again. One thing I would note is that the 3% number is all types of goods and services. Mm-hmm. The Fed tends to pay closer attention to is the core rate, and that's stripping out food and energy, which tend to be a lot more volatile, and they just cycle up and down a lot more quickly. So when they look at the core, that's still running pretty hot. It's fallen, but not quite as much. And so that's what they're going to want to see come down further before they really declare victory and go home.
I wonder about a perception gap over inflation, because I feel like as a consumer myself, I notice energy prices, gas prices that are on signs everywhere you walk and drive, food prices I notice when I go grocery shopping. How much of a gap can there be between our perception as consumers and what the Federal Reserve and others are looking at when it comes to inflation?
Yeah, that's a good point, because when you look at the graph of year-over-year inflation rates and you see it coming down, that looks really great. But it's not saying that prices are coming down. It's just saying that prices are growing less quickly. So if you think back to 3 years ago, you know, your broccoli or your gas or your car insurance are still going to be quite a bit more than they were back then, on average about 21% more. So until you see prices actually fall, which we're not sure will happen, it's still going to be a frustrating situation for consumers.
Now, there have been big, long arguments, some of them on this show, about what drove that inflation. And people point toward, you know, post-COVID demand plus supply chain difficulties, government spending in the U.S. and elsewhere, the war in Russia and Ukraine. Some of those are in the rearview mirror, I think, mostly, obviously not the Russia-Ukraine war. What do people point to as factors for the inflation rate coming down from that peak last year?
Yeah, and you know, the fight I find kind of dumb, because obviously all of those things played a role, and economists have offered many explanations for how much of a role each one played. So there's room for debate around that. But in terms of why inflation has fallen, so it's funny, because at the outset, the Fed got a lot of flack for saying that we think inflation is transitory. It's going to be over before you know it. Obviously, that was wrong, but it was wrong in the short term. In the long term, there's a lot of goods and services that came back down kind of naturally as a reversion to the mean, right? We see this most pronounced in the price of goods, because those were the things that we all bought all at once, driving up the price. Combine that with supply chain snarls, made them very scarce and drove up the prices very high. Now, all of that is clearing out, right? Like, those long backups at the ports are pretty much resolved. Most factories are back online. We've stuffed our houses as full as they can get with new couches. And so those kinds of prices are pretty much almost back to where they were. Now, the thing that is continuing and preventing inflation from sinking as quickly are some of your prices, right? Your haircuts, your amusement parks. And that's because what followed the run-up in prices was workers saying, we need better wages in order to afford the new cost of living, which then drove up the price of services, which has prevented the overall rate from falling as much as it could have.
We're talking about the latest inflation news with Lydia DePillis from the New York Times. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234. Lydia, one fundamental cost that people are facing if they want to find a new place to live, housing, a report by the National Low Income Housing Coalition found, if you are a minimum wage worker, there is no state, county, or city in the United States where you can afford a two-bedroom apartment. How do things like housing factor into how we measure inflation?
Yeah, well, I mean, the minimum wage statistic you cited probably is more a commentary on the minimum wage than it is about the price of housing. But yeah, so that is one of those goods that... So when we talked about why inflation is falling, right, I sort of neglected to mention the Fed's increased interest rates, right? Because that was its remedy to sky high inflation. It wanted to make borrowing more expensive, which makes businesses slow down. They don't hire as much. People don't have as much spending power. And so they don't spend as much on goods and services. So the prices come down, right? So, so that translated pretty quickly into the housing market, right? Because if you need to borrow a bunch of money to buy a home, instead of 3% interest rates, you're going to have to pay 7-8%. And that adds hundreds of dollars to a monthly payment, which has driven up prices even higher than they were, just naturally because people were moving into bigger spaces. People were decoupling from family members because they wanted to separate out and move to further out locations during the pandemic, right? So all of that has driven up the cost of housing a ton. And it hasn't really been falling because we have this very constrained supply. And the irony of that is that interest rates operate in a couple of different ways. One is trying to suppress the prices, but the other is suppressing construction. So the fact that builders now have to pay more for construction loans has made it so that it's harder to build apartments. So that supply is slowing down, and also single family homes. And also it's made it so that people who already own their homes, the last thing they want to do is sell it if they'd have to turn around and buy something else at a much higher interest rate. So all of that is combined to make it a really frustrating situation for anyone who's trying to buy a home. If you're trying to rent a home, prices are coming down gradually. That's part of the picture in what's bringing down overall inflation. But again, those prices are a lot higher than they were at the before the pandemic started.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Wauwatosa. Chris, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to, the caller or the speaker was talking about inflation and workers' wages. And it just seems like nobody ever really talks about the impact that is that, you know, more money flowing to the top and larger profit margins and payouts to like shareholders and stuff, how that never. It seems like that's never talked about.
Yeah. Chris, thanks a lot for the call. And you have talked about this elsewhere, Lydia, accusations of greedflation, the idea that companies can boost their profits by keeping prices higher because we're used to paying higher prices.
Yeah, there's been a lot of debate around this. And I do think it is an element of what we're seeing, right? All of these factors are playing a role in inflation. When inflation is high, because of initially all of these supply chain issues we talked about, that makes it a lot easier for corporations to say, well, consumers expect prices to be high, so maybe we can hide a little extra profits amongst all of that. And so you really did see profits spike. And, you know, some orthodox economists will usually say, well, it's just supply and demand. When supply is down, prices go up. That allows the market to clear, but it does manifest in much higher profits. And it also, companies have gotten used to those profits. And if they're very large companies that have a greater share of the market than they might have 10, 30 years ago, they are able to exert pricing power and keep those prices higher for longer. And we really have seen this in particular in the car market, some of the consumer packaged goods like your chips and sodas. So that is absolutely a factor. We're not totally sure on how much it's actually driven inflation, but you're not wrong to think, Chris, that is a feature. And when it comes to wages, so we actually have seen some of the biggest wage increases in decades for especially low wage workers, which has been really encouraging, but they haven't felt it very much because inflation has been higher. And only recently has that started to turn around, where wage growth is moving faster than inflation, putting more spending power in people's pockets. Hopefully those wage gains will stick around while inflation is falling, making it a little bit easier to make ends meet.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Lydia DePillis, reporter on the business desk at the New York Times. We're talking about a decline in the inflation rate in the latest data, what that could mean for the American economy, and the prices we pay for stuff. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has inflation affected your household budget? Are you feeling the cooling effects of lower inflation this summer or not? Is there a particular item that's challenging for you, whether it's housing or you needed a new car or something, or maybe just your grocery bill that stood out to you as you're paying a lot more than you used to? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about inflation and all of its cousins, a greedflation, wageflation, shrinkflation, maybe even some Beyonceflation. Economics reporter Lydia DePillis from the New York Times is here to help us sort it all out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed the impact on your life of higher prices over this last year? Are you seeing any relief? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. A couple things. We talked about how inflation is going down. I believe about 16% or maybe a little more of the index is energy. And so some of that reduction in inflation, price inflation, is due to the president administration sacrificing our petroleum reserves, emergency reserves, to hold prices down or to lower them, whatever they could. And second, I think food costs are going to go up because Ukraine violated the grain deal by using ocean-going drones to attack the civilian infrastructure of the Kerch Bridge. And so now the grain supply is going to be at a much higher price.
Jim, thanks for the call. And Russia, of course, attacking Ukrainian grain supplies and backing out of a deal. Let's start with that oil point. First of all, Lydia, one of the least predictable things out there, I'm looking at a chart of oil prices. It goes up and down a lot. How much is something like releasing some strategic oil reserves, or, as our caller mentioned, going to help bring that price down and help bring overall inflation down?
Yeah, I mean, using the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to try to bring more supply onto the market, which obviously had been constrained by global disruptions, it was widely credited for being fairly successful, right? It's very difficult for the president to control the price of anything because it is so subject to global supply and demand, from how fast China is growing to how much supply OPEC wants to put on the market. So Jim is right that that was a huge factor in overall prices coming down. Where that goes in the future, it's not really clear, because other types of energy are starting to become increasingly important when it comes to fueling our cars or heating our homes. And yes, there's a big concern that food prices will go up because of continued fighting in Ukraine, and most recently, as you noted, the determination by the Russians to stop the grain trade. But that might be a bigger problem, to be honest, for some of the emerging markets that really depend on that grain, and Europe, the U.S. obviously is a huge producer of food in its own right.
Thanks for that call. Jeff joins us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I love talking about this. It's so important for us to be educated. Our GDP is about $34 trillion a year. My question is, the money that is in circulation in our economy, how does that affect inflation every year?
Jeff, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, thank you, Jeff. I mean, I think that it's a big blunt instrument, right? The money supply classically was usually thought of as the main, maybe even sole driver of price growth or degrowth. And I think that things have gotten more complicated. And there's a lot more factors that are on a micro level going to influence day-to-day changes. Now, the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates, so that means sort of gradually reducing the money supply. You might attribute the sinking inflation to that in part, but we don't really know how much of that has sunk in yet, right? The classic Milton Friedman dictum that changes in interest rates act with long and variable lags, that might have sped up because information flow has increased in recent years, which means that the transmission from monetary policy into markets might have been accelerated, right? So if you were keeping an eye on your 401k last year, you probably noticed it was much smaller at the end of 2022 than it was at the beginning. And that's because monetary policy had an impact on the price of equities. So it's a fair question, but I do think it's just much more complicated than we once thought it was.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Talking about inflation with Lydia DePillis with the business desk at the New York Times. Lydia, I want to touch on a few different angles of inflation. This idea was around before COVID, shrinkflation. The idea like, okay, hey, this box of cereal costs the same as it used to. Hey, wait a minute, it's got 4 ounces less cereal in it. A sort of sneaky way to deal with inflation. How big a factor is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that our federal data agencies don't really track. Mm-hmm. But, you know, your grocery store should have a price per ounce so you can actually tell whether that's going up or down. So I think that was a clever workaround, especially in that sort of consumer packaged goods category where, you know, you notice your box of grape nuts. It looks a little bit smaller, but you can't really tell because it's the same dimensions. So that kind of thing probably is one of the more sticky ways in which companies have managed to sell less but make more. and so I think that's the kind of thing that you should keep a really close eye on. There's a bunch of websites that track this sort of thing. So if you're really into getting more for your money, make sure you don't get deceived by that kind of tactic.
I mentioned shrinkflation. There's greedflation, a lot of others. Last month, the Guardian newspaper reported that people in Sweden were blaming inflation on a Beyonce concert in Stockholm, calling it Beyonceflation. Are we reaching peak prefixflation use here? Are we overdoing this?
Well, I think where everyone is certainly sick of this inflationary moment and would like everything to get back to normal. I mean, the Beyonce episode to me was more an illustration of how national markets for extremely popular things have just made prices for that kind of exceptional item with limited supply, right? There's only so many seats at a Beyonce concert. Incredibly expensive, right? We all know about the same things now. So there's sort of less diversity in cultural output in a way. Like just think about the Barbie movie this past weekend, right? We're all because we all are tuned into the same social media and TV channels, know that this thing is really exciting. And so I'm sure prices for movie tickets will probably show a bump just for the month of July.
Speaking of tickets, you wrote earlier this month about plane tickets, a summer drop in airfare prices after them going, seemed like up and up. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, and that's an example of a market where there's a lot going on, right, both on the supply and the demand side. I think, though, that this year it is really a normalization of the supply side, where airlines have figured out how to keep their, you know, pilot rosters full and stewardesses and, you know, ground crews, obviously not without hiccups. There's been plenty of that. But after a situation where they went from a total icy freeze in 2020, mothballed a bunch of planes, and then had to come out of that in the middle of emergence from the pandemic, huge surge in demand, all those forces are kind of normalizing now. And now all we have to worry about is giant storms and runways that are too hot to fly on. And I just, you know, one thing I will note on that is that a big lurking force here is actually climate change, because that's a really disruptive force when it comes to the supply of all kinds of things, from food to energy to housing to cars, right? If you have a hurricane, it wipes out a bunch of homes and cars. So that's the kind of thing that economists are worried that in the long term will keep price growth higher, because we just have these big whacks to the supply of things we need.
One bit of economic news just out here. People have been worried about a UPS strike. Could have been a big shock, a lot of disruption to the economy and the supply chain. Looks like there's a deal that strike will not happen. They've reached an agreement. How big a deal is it that we're going to avoid that six-digit 340,000 worker strike?
Yeah, no, that's huge news. I'm sitting here in the Times newsroom, and there was a kerfuffle when it happened because we'd prepared for what the consequences of a long-term strike would be, and it would be really significant because we all depend so much now on package delivery, is increasingly since the pandemic, right? And so, but it's also great news for labor. You know, I'm not super familiar yet with the details of the deal, but it sounds like those workers got something that they were satisfied with. And that's good news for the sustainability of wage increases. We've got a few more labor discussions on the horizon. The United Auto Workers are also entering bargaining with the big three automakers. So we'll see what happens there, because that's something that could really impact the price of cars if they decide that they're not getting what they want from their employers. So, you know, it's been quite an interesting summer of of strikes and almost strikes. And I do think that says a lot about how much workers want from this economy where they see prices, where they see companies raking in profits and have the same expenses.
Lydia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure thing.
That's Lydia DePillis, a reporter on the business desk at the New York Times. She joined us today for a look at what's going on with inflation lately, what it all means for the U.S. economy and for you. Coming up after the news, we get the latest on criminal investigations into former President Trump and attempts to overturn the 2020 election. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.